I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Mark Schneider joins me now, the journalist, joins me to reflect on his over 35-year career, his retirement since, as well as matters contemporary. We'll talk about the American election, I'm sure, as well as the ongoing constitutional challenge of the Medicare system by Dr. Brian Day. I'll ask Mr. Schneider about journalism today, television news, and pressing contemporary issues, and how he sees them being covered by the media today. Mark Schneider was with CTV for many years, serving as Vancouver bureau chief of the CTV National News, as well as a reporter on ethics and technology until 2008. A lot of us remember his years as the Ottawa bureau chief for BCTV when they had a reporter and a bureau in the nation's capital. Before that, he was a reporter and producer on the Jack Webster television program, as well as a reporter on CBC television and CBC radio. He established one of Canada's first community radio stations in Alert Bay in 1975. In his retirement, I understand he sailed a lot. I'll ask him about his adventures on the water. The Twitter handle is at WiseInNewsGuy. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in person today, Mark Schneider. Mr. Schneider, good morning.
Hello, Joe.
Thanks for coming
in
today.
Call me Mark.
I will call you Mark, but I don't know. I always open the show calling the guest Mr. or Ms. I don't.
No, that's good. It's formal, and it sets the tone, and I appreciate that, but
yeah.
I'm just Mark.
Yeah. So it was 2008 that you took leave of television. You were one of those cases, I guess, that was asked to leave, right?
I was, yeah. I had... Now, I'm still under a non-disclosure agreement with CTV as the basis of a very generous...
After 8 years?
...settlement. You know what? It was the best career move of my life. And the people who I had disagreements with, I have nothing but gratitude for them. I'm not trying to gild the lily here.
Sure.
I completely believe that.
And so what have you been doing since? I understand from a mutual friend of ours that you've been sailing a lot.
Yeah, I've got a sailboat in Mexico, and I spend quite a bit of time traveling up and down the Pacific coast of California and Mexico, and spend about 6 months a year on my sailboat.
And despite that, a life of leisure and retirement, if you will, you still keep in touch with current affairs, and I'm sure, like everyone else, you're talking about this American election.
Well, for me, I see it as kind of an occupational disease, being overly fascinated with the news. But these days, my pleasure is being a news consumer. But I have to tell you, since the revelations about the FBI reopening its investigation into Hillary Clinton, I've decided that I'm taking a bit of a pause.
Yeah.
I've gotten so wrapped up in it, I feel like personally invested.
Yeah.
And at this point, I realize it's out of my hands.
Yeah.
I can't make a difference in America turning the wrong way and maybe building the foundation for a fascist government. So I know the news, but I'm not following it from minute crisis to minute crisis.
But there has been no American election like this, has there?
No. No, there's not. And I'm an American, too.
I'm
a dual citizen, and I've always followed American politics. Of course, as a bureau chief in Ottawa and a member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery, I still maintain a vestigial interest in Canadian politics. But really, it's just not as interesting right now.
Yeah.
And I think that's good for Canada to be uninteresting. You know, there is that that Yiddish curse that goes, may you live in interesting times, as a curse. And things are just so incredibly interesting and scary. It's like being, you know, in a house of horrors.
So what we're going to do in these next few minutes is reflect on Canadian media, because you were so much a part of it over the years. But just in terms of the American media, mm-hmm. and how they've been covering this election, because I'm sure you're like a lot of us who've watched various networks this last year and change. How do you think they've done in terms of covering this election? I mean, a lot of people are critical of the media on both sides, the left and the right.
You know, I've watched, in particular, I've watched Washington Post really clearly. And they were the first major national news organization to break out of this kind of false equivalence notion. And if people aren't really familiar, let me just say that false equivalence is where, as a journalist, you feel obliged to cover both sides of any dispute, regardless of the relative merits of either side.
So it's like the climate change, giving equal weight to, say, science and deniers, which one shouldn't, right?
That, no, one shouldn't. So, but and the Washington Post really was very early in trying to change that as a kind of restriction on how they do the news. And in, and then went a step further, which is to treat Donald Trump as a worthy news story in its own right, not requiring that they seek the other side, but to report on Trump as a phenomenon, as would be a plane crash, as would be a tidal wave, that all you need to do is report on the phenomenon itself without trying to balance it out. And the Washington Post has been very courageous in this. Sometimes they step over the line. They're now actually doing a kind of ingredients label, you know, like on food, you pick up and they, you, what's in it. They're now using some really interesting locutions, especially like on something like the plumb line. And I don't know if anybody knows what the plumb line is. It's a column written by a guy named Gary Sargent. And they call it, not creative nonfiction, opinion reporting. I think that's what they call it. And it's really interesting because it's not exactly opinion. It's not exactly journalism. But it's identified as kind of in between. And it's very interesting to see how far they've pushed that. I think that's really good for journalism. But I do see as well that Trump has been such a shock to the whole system that it's really hard to maintain kind of this normally accepted dispassionate approach by journalists because they see all these notions of civility just being completely trashed. What do you do when you're faced with that? It's been very difficult, and I wouldn't doubt that there will be a major hangover after the election in terms of the media, especially if Trump creates this media empire that people are speculating.
And do you think he's a story? Well, I guess he is a story because he's good copy, and he sells papers, and he gets people watching television. And I think that's what the media sort of needed at this moment, don't you think?
Well, you know, this is very interesting because in the last couple of days, media commentators like Jeff Jarvis and Jay Rosen have been talking a lot about CNN. Now, CNN has been a network that has been playing second fiddle to Fox News, both in terms of audience size and also influence.
Right.
And CNN has now gone to a new kind of profile, which is so entertaining to watch. Not Fox News, but in some cases really disturbing because they allow this kind of unrestrained, unbridled shout fest. I don't know what else to call it that is really also like the Washington Post breaking new ground. But I can tell you, very careful, concerned observers of the journalistic scene are really upset with what CNN is doing. So, you know, we're in a phase right now, Joe, where many people are thinking the whole mediascape is broken. The storytelling itself and the nature of the storytelling, the narratives have lost some kind of respect. So it's the disruption that Trump has added to an already disrupted mediascape means that who knows what is going to come out of this.
And in the week and change before the election, are you one of these people that thinks that he possibly could win this?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on whether there are other sort of October surprises coming up. It's possible. I mean, I've never seen a campaign handled as skillfully and as adroitly as Hillary's team has done. Yeah. I mean, I've covered many, many, you know, election campaigns in Canada and provincial ones in British Columbia, and I've been immersed in politics. I've never seen anything so skillfully and disciplined as Hillary Clinton's campaign team. It is phenomenal. But the question is, do they have anything else up their sleeve?
Yeah.
I don't know. If they don't have anything up their sleeve, and if Trump, who has been practicing this scorched earth process, if they have something else, and of course we know that Julian Assange has promised that the day before the election he has, you know, a neutron bomb ready to unleash, well, there's no way you can say that it's in the bag for Hillary at this point.
As someone who's been in the media as you have all these years, do you miss not being, say, part of this campaign and covering it?
Well, that's a really, really good question. You know, I heard an interview this morning on BBC World News Service. I listen to their podcasts all the time. And I was listening to a reporter who was a lobby correspondent. That's somebody who's, you know, parliamentary reporter. And I thought, oh, geez, I wish I was a lobby correspondent right now, because I know how to do it.
Yeah.
I really know how to do it. It's in my blood. But I'm an old man now, so I'm not going to do it. I mean, there's vestigial, you know, instincts and behaviors that I still engage in.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I've been more or less content to be just a news consumer.
And I guess this desire to say, look at the press came out recently in the summer when the Brian Day trial was about to start, and you wanted to do something about that.
Yeah, I did. I had started to think about what this was going to mean, and I realized that as I started getting interested in how this was, you know, what the trial was going to be like, I realized that the media would be there for the first week of what could be a 6 to 9 month trial. I know everybody's saying that this, and just to let your listeners know, on September 7th of this year, the Supreme Court opened a suit brought by Dr. Brian Day of Cambie Surgeries against the BC government, challenging the BC Medicare Protection Act with infringing on his constitutional rights as guaranteed in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Mm-hmm. And the more I looked, I knew what the trial date was, I realized that this was such a complicated trial, and knowing the parlous state of the news media, they'd be there for 1 week. They're not going to be there for the 6th.
Or a day, right?
Well, I predicted they would be there for 1 week.
Yeah.
And in the first day, everybody was there.
Yeah.
In the second day, there were three. On the third day, there was Ian Mulgrew and me. Even Canadian Press had dropped out.
Huh.
And the rest of the week, I had it completely to myself. What I so I had successfully anticipated what would happen.
Yeah.
And my response in August was to create what I called a pop-up newsroom.
Yeah.
A newsroom that had no overhead except for maybe some bandwidth charges. But what we would do is we would organize a cohort of retired, underemployed journalists and students in journalism programs to staff the trial for its duration. That meant going into the trial, finding out what was the most significant thing that happened that day, and producing, in a sense, a real bare-bones auditing of what was going on. This was not anticipated to have wide public interest, but for a few people, this would be great, because nobody could afford doing that. Even the BC Coalition for Healthcare could not figure out how to get an observer, just an observer, not a high-priced lawyerly help, but just an observer to be there every single day.
Yeah.
So I kind of figured out what we would need. I built the back end, some infrastructure, basically a supply chain that would organize, you know, the whole edit queue and approval, and invited my colleagues to participate in it.
And it's a pretty good list of people you put together, right?
Well, I did have some incredible supporters. I had Hal Wake, who is the artistic director of the Vancouver Writers Festival. Ross Howard, one of Canada's noted journalists who was in Ottawa for many years. Mike Tippett, who is a serial entrepreneur, who he had invited me to start a crowdsourcing news operation called Now Public, which ultimately had 120,000 editors from all over the world.
Yeah.
Dave Beers, who was the publisher of the Tie.
Yep.
Who else had been? Philip Klein, Peter Klein
from UBC.
From UBC and Global Reporting. I had just this incredible group of people who had liked the idea and said, yeah, you know, if you can put it together, we'll be your supporters and act as a kind of de facto advisory group. So the idea was based on the of a pop-up restaurant.
Yeah.
Somebody wants to do something good. They rent a place or get a food truck. They put it up. And then when the pop-up is over, you deflate the tent.
Yeah, and it's a great concept. So what happened?
I couldn't recruit anybody.
Hmm.
And there was a deeply flawed anticipation or expectation that people would jump at this. There were lots of journalists in the categories that I described who really thought it was a good idea. But it kind of fell apart because everybody needs money. And so many journalists and writers in this country have been burned by these online projects where they say, oh, give us your best stuff and it'll help your portfolio. And it ends up being slave labor. People have been burned by these models of volunteer journalism. And so I was in there doing it by myself and realized that I had failed. It was painful for me to have made a bit of a splash in the journalistic community and then having to collapse the tent before.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do feel a little bit of grief because I do think that it is an idea that is useful.
Yeah.
I still love the idea of the pop-up newsroom.
Yeah.
You know, low overhead. You create one when a big story shows up. And then when it's over, you fold up the tent. You don't have bills to pay or rent, you know, or, you know, contracts for data lines. And there are so many great online tools now that I had aggregated into kind of a journalistic dashboard. It's still there. So for the next time that a story comes up, it's ready to go. But what is still missing is the business case.
Yeah.
And that is something that I have yet to sort out.
Like, we've got an election coming up in May 2017. Is this something that you're thinking about
deploying? No, I don't think so, because that will be well covered by everybody.
Mm.
The thing about a pop-up and why the Medicare on Trial pop-up was, I think, compelling was that everybody knew that nobody would be doing this. Canadian media just can't afford to do it. In the old days, if this trial had come up when Jeffrey Simpson was still writing for the Globe and Mail, he would have been there as often as he could have been. And the Globe and Mail's readers would have benefited from the fact that he really knew this case inside and out. Nobody can afford to do that in Canada.
And it's,
nobody.
And it's such an important case, though, because, I mean, let's say he succeeds Dr. Day.
And I think there's a very good chance he will succeed.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that'll change how we get Medicare in this country, right?
I think, you know, I've seen the opening statement.
Mm-hmm.
Of Dr. Day's arguments. He has very, very compelling arguments, not the least of which are internal emails from the BC government bureaucracy that basically say, we don't know how to deal with this.
So the trial is ongoing?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and when does that do? How many months did you say?
Well, there, you know, the trial lawyers involved have all indicated there have been 24 weeks set aside for the hearings. But in talking to the lawyers on both sides, they think it may be even longer than that. It would not surprise me if it went on for 9 months.
And surely it'll go up higher to the Supreme Court, won't it?
Well, you have to game that out. If I think the way you game it out is, what happens if Brian Day loses? Will the BC government appeal?
Right.
You know, if they win, I know Brian Day will appeal. He's got very substantial backers in this. He doesn't have to worry. He's a prosperous man himself, but he also has the support of some independent organizations that have been raising money for him. I think it's inevitable if he loses, this will continue to the Supreme Court of Canada.
So this bridges us into a contemporary topic, and that is how the state of the media today and how it is that they are covering issues like this. I mean, that must disappoint you that this isn't on the news or even in the newspaper every day.
Well, it does disappoint me, but what's the greater disappointment is the turmoil that's being faced in the news industry itself. The newsrooms have been depopulated. As you know, in Vancouver, we've seen the newsrooms for the Vancouver Sun and the Province having been combined. They're only really separate publications by virtue of, you know, a corporate decision. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in them that promotes competitiveness. We've seen corporate concentration proceed apace, and it really hasn't helped anybody's bottom line. You know, the National Post is carrying a tremendous debt load. The problem, you would think that would have been great news for the Globe and Mail, but alas, advertising revenues, the mainstay of the news business, have been in precipitous decline now for at least 10 years, if not longer. We are in a state where we cannot afford classical in-depth journalism. We can't afford it. So the question is, where is it going to come from? And that's my concern. And the whole purpose of the pop-up, and many people are thinking about this, Joe. What do we need to do to support our newspapers and our local TV stations and radio? Nobody has a clear idea yet. Nobody. And yet, very smart news managers have been grappling this at least since 1995, when the internet really first started to make its introduction. So we are in a state where the very best minds, the most creative people in the business, don't know where the money is going to come from.
So is it a question of the public doesn't want to pay for it? One, two, they're not used to paying for it because of the internet the last 21 years or so. Or three, the audience is just dispersed.
All three.
A lot of the new generation doesn't care.
Your questions indicate a really close observation of what's going on. The only thing that is actually possible right now that I see is that the people who need the news will understand that they've got a civic responsibility to support it. I mean, really, when you think about the media and its place in modern global society, it is the neural network for the entire planet. It is the one that gives us feedback. We expect it to produce a competent, verifiable picture of what's important in the world. That is the social contract with the news business. We will let reporters and their organizations be rude and ask intemperate questions and, you know, basically go beyond where all the no trespassing signs are, because they're going to tell us what's going on in the world. Governments can't do this. No government can say, oh, here's what's going on. Here's the best of our intelligence. This is what you need to know as responsible citizens to fulfill your social responsibilities to society. The news business is doing this, but they've shown they can't do that. They are no longer what we expect them to do, to be this neural network, so we know how to fulfill our responsibilities. They cannot do it anymore. So those responsible citizens who are out there who need to know what's going on, they need to know where they're going to invest their energy, their money, what's going to take care of their communities, even locally, their neighborhoods, we're running blind right now. The neural network is down. It's not happening for a variety of reasons. So the only way that I see this is happening, especially in this time when governments are not likely to invest in public broadcasters like the CBC or NPR or PBS or BBC or ABC in Australia, is people are going to have to step up. People are going to have to step up if they want it.
And do you have hope that, because I'm of a generation that hasn't paid for this stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
I do.
Yeah. I pay. And I don't want to pay.
So how do you get people like me to take up a subscription or to
I don't know. I don't know.
Because you were in the TV business.
Yep.
And I remember watching you as a kid on the NewsHour with Tony, and you were in Ottawa.
Yep.
A lot of people my age now, people younger certainly, don't watch the evening news at 6 o'clock.
Nope.
They don't even watch the news at 10 o'clock or 11.
Nope.
So
how do we do this?
Yeah.
You know, I've been talking with some young people about this, and I've got a friend who is so smart. Well, I've got a few young people. Do you mind if I mention their
sure,
names?
Sure, go ahead, yeah.
Jennifer Pavolano. Mm. She was a student of mine.
She was a guest on the show when she was on when she worked for TransLink.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did the buzzer.
She did the buzzer. Now she's at City Hall doing social media outreach. And I had a great conversation with her just last week. And she says, you know what's missing is conversation. We don't talk to this, what you and I are doing, Joe, right now.
Yeah.
A lot of people would like to participate in this, but there is no platform for that happening. I mean, if we disagree with one another about public policy or, you know, the healthcare system, how do we talk to the people that we might disagree with? How do we become intimate about these things that are affecting our lives? And that was Jennifer's question. I've also been talking to Liam Wake, who is a really talented young person. And he said to me, you know, what I get most out of right now is the New Yorker magazine because it's satisfying. I feel like there's somebody who actually respects who I am, who is talking directly to me. And both of these two people, Liam and Jen, both, I think, are on the money in a very important way that we really do need to figure out storytelling. We really have to throw away our current kind of Elizabethan discourse that we use, and you hear this on CBC so much, this kind of
talking down
and ending a sentence with the importance of how brilliant I am. You hear that so much. I hate to spotlight CBC, but it is like an Elizabethan language. When you go watch Shakespeare, you hear this kind of discourse, which basically is saying, I'm smarter than you. And Liam and Jen have both put their fingers on something that's so important, which is somehow we've got to create this so that we're all involved in a very direct way. And I really don't know how that can be done, but I am listening to them. And anybody who wants to talk to me about what they think, they can get in touch with me at coordinator@newspopup.org.
And newspopup is one word?
Newspopup is one word. Write me and tell me what you're looking for.
Yeah.
I'm one of these old guys who is listening. I'm listening, folks. I want to hear from you.
So do you watch anything? What do you watch at 6 o'clock? What do you watch at 10 and 11?
You know, I tell you now, I program my own news. I've got a system where I subscribe to a variety of podcasts. They come in when I tell them to come in, instead of just having CBC Radio on all the time.
Making sure you're there at the top of the hour.
I'm there, and I hear the latest stuff, and I program for myself. That's what I do.
And that's what a lot of people think. That's what everyone's doing.
Well, they're listening to you, aren't they?
Some people are, yeah.
But you're on the right track. You're completely on the right track. And I think that's one thing that's going to happen, is that people can now be discriminating, and they don't have to be broadcast to. See, that's essentially the difference. In all the years I spent in broadcast journalism, it's like the programmers take a handful of darts, and they've got the dartboard. They have a handful of darts because they don't know what is actually going to hit the target. So they take this handful of darts, and they throw it at the dartboard, and some are going to stick.
Yeah.
But the downside of it is that everybody knows essentially what they're getting is form letter news.
I guess that's why I started this 13 years or so ago, was because I wanted something that I would want to listen to. And that's like the long-form interview, because you don't get that even on the CBC. You get, 5 minutes at the most. I mean, 5 minutes is a very long time on public radio and commercial radio. And I figured the Internet, you have as much space as you want on the Internet. You can talk to someone for 45 an hour about whatever you want to ask them, and then it's there.
Right. So the only advice I would get, after listening to Jennifer and Liam, the only thing that I would suggest for you is that think of these interviews as being an invitation to a conversation where other people can participate in.
Yeah. And I guess Twitter and Facebook, I mean, that
there's
helps,
lots of
doesn't
tools
it?
Out
you know?
There's lots of tools.
So one of the reasons why I invited you on today was talk about your thoughts on various issues. But I also wanted to, as I told you already, you're someone that I watched growing up. You were in Ottawa the late 80s to the early 90s.
Yeah, there 6 years.
Yeah. And then before that, you were at BCTV, of course, on the Webster Show, and then on BCTV as a reporter there. Those years in Ottawa, it's hard to believe now that BCTV had a full-time reporter in Ottawa.
Not just a full-time reporter, but a brilliant cameraman, Paul Nolan, who was just like still is one of Canada's most brilliant cameramen. And Gavin Conway, who is a brilliant mind. I mean, just a brilliant mind who's gone on to huge success in the UK. Their investment in us, BCTV's investment in our bureau, was, I just accepted it as normal.
Yeah.
It does not exist anymore.
Yeah.
They, nobody can afford to do it, which is why everybody, all the news organizations, are going to what I think of as this kind of form letter kind of news, where news becomes a commodity, like gasoline or electricity. You don't, when you fill up your tank or plug into a wall socket, you don't say, is this the best electricity I can get? You don't even think about that. But in news, that should be the question.
Yeah.
That should be the number one question.
But at the same time, those years that you were at BCTV, everybody watched that. And, they just assumed that they were going to watch Tony at 6, or they were going to watch the Webster Show at 9. It so dominated the market.
Especially BCTV, which had twice as many viewers when I was there as all the other TV stations combined.
Yeah, so what's happened to that station in particular?
I don't know. I really don't know. I hate to say this, but because of what's been happening, in American politics, I really have kind of lost interest in... I hate to say this. This is a terrible thing to say. But... I'll tell you just a quick little story. A few weeks ago, I had gathered with a bunch of my former colleagues for the birthday of Ross Howard, a dear friend of mine. And we were all, I don't want to mention any names, but we were people who really followed the political scene very closely.
People that I would have read and watched,
right? Oh, yes,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You would know these names who came out for Ross's birthday. And... we were really critical of the governments in those days. We had spanned people from Pierre Trudeau, to Brian Mulroney and Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin. And we were tough. We were really tough. And now as old men, we were getting together for Ross's birthday. And darn it if we didn't say, this country is pretty well run. As old men, as old you know, reporters, we realized that this country is exactly the kind of country that most people in the world would like to be part of. Yeah. Our corruption is actually quite low for, you know, a lot of countries. And for the most part, our politicians, regardless of the party they're in, are actually pretty committed to doing the right thing. We're not going through the upheavals that the United States is going through. But from a journalistic perspective, it kind of makes things, especially when you've got this nightmare to the south of us, it makes us relatively boring. Sorry, but that's a good thing. I'm not saying that we shouldn't expend journalistic resources. Of course we should. But for me, an old-timer, what is going on this day in the United States really is almost like an extinction-level event. I believe that. And that's what I've been focused on. So I can't tell you anything about the, you know, the details of Canadian reporting.
Do you have, say, a remedy as to get people to watch TV news again?
No.
Do you think that's finished? The relevance of, say, a Mansbridge or a Lisa LaFlamme at CTV?
No, I just don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't know. I mean, I think that for one problem is the whole notion of terrestrial broadcasting is over and done with, big time. And that's a problem. What's also over and done with is the kind of temporal location of programming. The fact that it happens at a particular time, that is also... So if those two things are gone, then what replaces it? And that's like a fundamental question. We don't know what's going to replace the fact of that predictability of turning on at 6 o'clock and seeing Tony Parsons or Bill Good or, you know... Well, Gloria Macarenko, whoever is there, nothing has replaced it yet. And from what I see, the millennials are not so interested in, you know, getting things at the same time.
Or from the same people, right?
Or the same people, the time of day that's going on. I mean, you know, you can get it on your smartphone when you need it. And you can get precisely what you need.
I guess, because I've had all the anchors on over the years.
Does this disappoint you, what I'm saying?
It does, a little bit.
I know, it is disappointing as hell.
Because this is what I grew up with, and I expect
that. But Joe, it's the next step that we've got to now be concerned
about. And you're older than I am, and you're trying to convince me.
Well, I think you're an old soul myself.
I think I am, yeah. And unfortunately so. But, you know, I've had all the anchors on over the years, and you know, they like to say that their product is important, especially... when stuff breaks. So if there's a September 11th on, happening, I should say, you go to the TV and you're waiting for the Walter Cronkite-type anchor to tell you what's happening and tell you how to get through this. Those days are gone, obviously.
Well, I think in times of crisis, like 9/11 or this, you know, election in the United States, there's a lot of people. I mean, you know, CNN is just raking in piles of money right now. So it does happen, but for the day-to-day kind of quotidian stuff that is the meat and potatoes of the news business, not so much.
Yeah. Maybe you are hopeful, though, that civilized people can still have high-minded conversations.
Yeah, you know, but I don't have any answers.
Yeah.
I mean, my pop-up idea was an idea that I think might be able to fit within the current news ecosystem. And what I mean by a news ecosystem is, like, if you think about in the natural world, you have resource inputs and you have species which both contribute and subtract from it. And there's an energy source that maintains the vitality of the ecosystem. Well, we don't have a news ecosystem that is sustainable right now. And I do believe that there are things that we can try, but it's all experimental. It's all experimental. And we look at the experiments that are happening, like Vice News and Vox and in Canada, you know, we've got Rabble and we've got the Tai, and their Ricochet is, you know, starting up in Vancouver. And But everything is experimental at this stage.
Yeah.
There's nothing that you can take to the bank. I just tried to do another pop-up on the road to legalization of marijuana, which I thought would be a natural pop-up. You know, we're on a path. Normal news media can cover it episodically. But last week, I saw an article. I've set up all these news alerts, which was that Shoppers Drug Mart has applied. Wants to sell it in the grocery store.
Yeah.
Shoppers Drug Mart has the most valuable Canadian brand there is. There is no brand that is more valuable in Canada than Shoppers Drug Mart. And they're proposing to carry a substance which heretofore has been considered consumed by degenerates only. Most respectable brand? A degenerate product? The time has passed for that pop-up.
And Trump could be president, right?
And Trump could be president.
Where are we? Where are we, Mark? This has been such a delight to meet you after all these years.
Yeah, thank you, Joe.
I've been a fan, and I hope this will start a conversation between us, because you're welcome on any time.
Oh, I really appreciate that invitation. I'm off to join my boat now again.
Ah, where are you off to?
I leave tomorrow morning and head to my boat, which is in La Paz, Mexico, and I'll be starting the long trek bringing the boat home.
And then when does that? I mean, that you're not going right away, so you're going to stop off and.
I mean, first of all, I have to bash up the coast of the Baja Peninsula, which is a bit aggressive. And then there's sort of hopscotching up the wintertime as far north as I can get. Hope to make it to San Francisco, where I've got a sister, and then bring the boat up here in the fall. I mean, next spring.
Yeah, so I mean, you're going to miss the rain and the ugliness that's Vancouver today.
I know, but I've been loving it. It's like the whole world here is air conditioned, and that's pretty nice.
Well, thanks for this, and we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Yeah, thank you so much, Joe.
Wizened News Guy is a Twitter handle. Mark Schneider joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planto.